chapter 10. As we were finishing up last week in verse 37 of chapter 9, it reads, Joshua made them that day, referring to the Gibeonites, hewers of wood and drawers of water for the congregation and for the altar of Jehovah to this day in the place which he would choose. So there was a, as usual, there's a little bit of confusion or maybe some extra thoughts about to this day. Does that mean to this day or to some other day? And so I've been wrestling with this all through the whole chapter that we've been through so far, because that phraseology and that idea is used quite a bit. And I've pretty much settled in my mind that I need to watch the context really close to figure out what to this day represents according to the context. Well, in this particular one, it could be a little sticky, because if we're reading Joshua and he's speaking this word, these words, and all these things have just occurred, he might be talking pretty close into the presence or present of his time. Well, that's good. That's good and well for some cases. In this particular one, we have some more information concerning the Gibeonites, and we find that in 2 Samuel chapter 21, verses 1 through 6. And I believe I brought that up a little bit last week. And this is during the time of David and Saul, the kings of Israel there, and it concerns the Gibeonites. It seems as though when Saul was king, he wanted to get rid of the Gibeonites, execute them all. And so he did put to death quite a few of them. And the Gibeonites that are still alive, after Saul's already dead now, come to David, and they want revenge or retribution, so to speak, for their dead that Saul had killed. So we know from that that the Gibeonites are still part of the Israelite nation. So to this day, extends a ways past Joshua in this particular case. It's as near as I can tell, unless I'm thinking it all wrong or sideways or whatever. So I guess long and short of it is that we need to be kind of careful when we say, well, it means this day, or it means that day, or it means something way in the past or something in the future. Are there any comments on what I've just said? Anything you'd like to add or anything you'd like to take away?
Who wrote the book of Joshua?
I don't know the answer to that. Maybe you could help me out there.
To this day, it was written after Joshua's life. The events were written by somebody else. I don't know. Dean, do you know?
My best understanding is that Joshua is a compilation. Probably part of it was written by Joshua himself. Part of it probably was written by the priests, who were reflecting on some of the things that went on in Joshua. You get a pretty accurate reflection if you read 1st and 2nd Chronicles, because that's 1st and 2nd Samuel, 1st and 2nd Kings, for instance, is the history that was written probably by an official scribe who was writing down the things that were happening, kind of keeping a track of what was going on for the king. And then 1st and 2nd Chronicles is the priest's view of what was written in 1st and 2nd Samuel, 1st and 2nd Kings. So they cover the same time period. One is the political perspective. The other one is the priestly perspective. And they don't always agree entirely. Because, you know, that's not surprising. The king's perspective is different than God's perspective on what's going on. That doesn't say that they weren't both inspired. It just says that they're written from slightly different perspectives. And in this case, I think Joshua was probably written by the priestly tribe to give an interpretation of and an addition to some of the things that were written, just as a history of what was going on with Joshua.
Yeah.
So you have the history and you have the interpretation. And my perspective on this is that when the writer says it's continued that way until this day, that's until the point when I'm writing it down.
Okay. Thank you. And we do know for a fact that it was after Joshua's life, or very near to the end, because it chronicles Joshua's activities. All right. Thank you very much. Appreciate all your input. And with that, let's begin reading in verse 1 of chapter 10. Now it came about when Adonai Zedek, king of Jerusalem, heard that Joshua had captured Ai and had utterly destroyed it, just as he had done to Jericho and its king, so he had done to Ai and its king, and that the inhabitants of Gibeon had made peace with Israel and were within their land, that he feared greatly because Gibeon was a great city, like one of the royal cities, and because it was greater than Ai, and all its men were mighty. Therefore, Adonai Zedek of Jerusalem sent word to Hoham, king of Hebron, and to Piram, king of Jarmuth, and to Japhia, king of Lachish, and to Debir, king of Elgon, saying, "Come up to me and help me, and let us attack Gibeon, for it has made peace with Joshua and with the sons of Israel." So, why did Adonai Zedek fear Gibeon? What did the text say?
Because it was a great city.
Okay, it was a great city.
And it was bigger than Ai.
And it was bigger than Ai.
And its men were mighty.
Its men were mighty. Okay, all of those three things.
And they had made peace with Joshua. And important because if Gibeon has made peace with Joshua, and Joshua is going around destroying all of these other cities, we need to be afraid of Gibeon because they're going to have to fight alongside Joshua.
Okay. That was kind of... I had a so what question here that you just answered, but we can go ahead and talk about it. So what? So they're, first off, they were in their land. Whose land? They're in Israel's land now. Gibeon was a great city, described as being one of the royal cities. What difference would that make? Described as one of the royal cities. What would that mean? I hear some mumbling. Carolee?
It was probably heavily fortified.
That's where I went too. I think so too. Yeah, it's heavily fortified. In fact, it's said that all of its men were mighty. So it was greater than Ai also. And we know what happened there. Totally destroyed. So my so what questions were, they're a bunch of slaves, a nation of slaves. Aren't they?
Yep.
They are now, aren't they, Carolee? Or Carol?
But the kings
in the land don't know that they're slaves, or don't know whether or not they will fight with or without, or with the Joshua or not. They're assuming that they will fight with Joshua because they are now in a covenant.
Yeah, I was going to say, which one of those answers did you want to go with? Yeah, and as just as Dean said, that Israel has a responsibility now to defend the Gibeonites, don't they? Because they made a covenant with them, a covenant before God, and this covenant is so important that they couldn't, the Israelites couldn't go in and clean house on them, because they swore an oath before God, and they would be, they would have blood on their hands, so to speak. They would be the covenant breakers if they went in and destroyed the Gibeonites, just because the Gibeonites tricked them, lied to them. Carol?
But the kings have to assume that the Gibeonites will fight with Joshua. They don't realize that Joshua will be defending them, because they're not going to let them wage war, I don't think. If they're going to be carriers of wood and water, they're not going to be fighters. So the five kings are under a misunderstanding, and so they're going to attack the part that they know.
I can see some of that logic, and I can agree with some of that. Of course, it's a supposition on our part, isn't it? But what we do know is that Israel will come to their cry for help. So, let's see. I'm trying to think back to what I was thinking a day or two ago when I did this. My long-term memory is not any longer than my short-term memory. But I wanted to make a point, and we come across this a lot, and it's all throughout Deuteronomy, which I constantly go back and refer to the fact that the Israelites are doing God's will and God's bidding. Deuteronomy chapter 11 and verse 25. The reading there says, "There shall be no man be able to stand before you," referring to the Israelites. "Jehovah your God shall lay the dread of you and the fear of you on the land on which you set foot, as he has spoken to you." Well, the "you" there is Moses. But it gets carried forward to Joshua too, as we keep reading on through Deuteronomy. And Exodus 15, verses 14 through 16, we have there what's called the Song of Moses and Israel. And in that, those particular verses 14 through 16, the narrative is about being redeemed, about being purchased. The Israelites are in that situation. They're God's people, and he stands for them and protects them. So moving on to question number two, why did Adoni-Zedek want to attack Gibeon in the first place? Well, first place, it's because they know, at least maybe I'm... No, it's in the scripture reading there. It's because they made peace with Joshua and with the sons of Israel. Well, if they're Palestinians, if they're Canaanites, they're all going to want to stick together. You know, like the Republicans on one side and the Democrats on the other. They don't cross. And there's also the covenant that we spoke about. And a covenant is the same today as it was back then. if we make a covenant or a treaty, say with Japan, when Japan surrendered in the Second World War, that was an unconditional surrender, and part of that surrender involved the fact that the United States was the protector of the Japanese nation from then on. And it may still be today, I don't know. But I know that we're allies with Japan, so if there's an aggressor that's moving on Japan, it behooves the United States to step in and help out. And we have a lot of those agreements or treaties with nations throughout the world. So a covenant or treaty is pretty important. And the Gibeonites want the Israelites to come and defend them. Did anyone help the king of Jerusalem there in question number 5? Well, we know the answer to that is
yes.
So, if we read verse 5 there, we see that so the five kings of the Ammonites, the king of Jerusalem, the king of Hebron, the king of Jarmuth, the king of Lachish, and the king of Eglon gathered together and went up, they with all their armies, and camped by Gibeon and fought against it. So how many kings were there? 5? Just 5?
Include the Jerusalem king.
Okay, that's 5. Those are the first ones mentioned. But then we have that plus. We have the king of Hebron, Jarmuth, Lachish, and Elgon. Unless I read that text incorrectly, or my mind's not following the thought there. That makes 10 altogether. Gathered together. They went up with their armies, camped by Gibeon, and fought against it.
Hold on, we're counting.
I see some activity over there. I see the fingers.
Take a shoe off. Because verse 5 says the 5 kings.
Well, okay, so if we look at the context, if it says the 5 kings plus the king of Jerusalem, and then it names 5 other kings.
Okay, you win.
Okay. Now, I might be all wet. I mean, I have been before. Bill?
You are. It names the nations that they're from, and they're the same 5 nations.
Okay.
I thought Ammonites were different from Canaanites.
Amorites. So it's really kind of difficult to call each one of these little... They're more like principalities to call it. Or city-states. They're not big nations. When somebody says nation to me, I think of China, United States, Russia. You know, I think big. But all... These are all little city-states. Kind of like Morocco. Is that right? Monaco.
These people are... They're like mayors.
Yeah, okay.
All kings.
Yeah.
They rule that one particular city.
Yeah, in fact, the king is not even capitalized, is it? So it's not a proper...
And I think that one of the things that the reason why these kings got together to punish Gibeon was they wanted to make sure that the rest of the cities in the neighborhood weren't going to do the same thing that the Gibeonites were.
Yeah, okay.
So... They're going to go out there and punish you to make sure that nobody else does the same thing.
Right. We're going to bully them a little bit. I'm going to keep them in line. Okay, so what did Gibeon do in verse 6? Then the men of Gibeon sent word to Joshua to the camp at Gilgal, saying, "Do not abandon your servants. Come up to us quickly and save us. Help us. For all the kings of the Amorites that live in the hill country have assembled against us." Help, 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 save us. Why do you think we made peace with you? You're big and strong, and we're just little bitty. So they sent word to Joshua, didn't they? And they used the phrase, "Do not abandon your servants." Now, when I read that, the first thing I thought was, they're playing the defenseless card. We're your servants. Here we are, we're defenseless against this big crowd. Well, weren't they described as being valiant men and a mighty city at the beginning of the chapter? So come up quickly, save us, help us. All the Amorites are assembled against us. So they're pretty emphatic that they want what they're supposed to get. Because they have a covenant with Israel. Israel is duty bound to step up and protect them. Okay, verses 7 through 9 will answer, use to answer question number 5 of Bill. Would you read 7 through 5 or 9 for us, please?
So Joshua went up from Gilgal, he and all the people of war with him, and the mighty men of valor. Jehovah said unto Joshua, "Fear them not, for I have delivered them into thy hands. There shall not a man of them stand before thee." Joshua therefore came upon them suddenly, for he went up from Gilgal all the night.
All right. Thank you very much. So what did Joshua do? Yeah, he did the right thing. He did the right thing. He went up to Gilgal, and the up there describes what the country's like. This is hill country. Then they came upon them suddenly, meaning on the Amorites, and they did this by marching all night. So all the way from Gilgal, which probably wasn't real far. It would have been within a night's march, right? So they were probably pretty tuckered out, wouldn't you think? Marching all night with whatever armor that they carried, their weapons. I don't know if they would have been carrying any food, but they would have carried their own weapons for sure. And the admonition there in verse 8 is, "Not one of them shall stand before you." We've heard this idea over and over and over all through the book of Joshua so far. It's the same statement as we come across in Joshua chapter 1 and verse 5. "No man will be able to stand before you all the days of your life." All the days of Joshua's life, no man will ever be able to stand before them. So how were the Ammonites overcome? Richard? Would you please read us verses 10 and 11?
Okay, there's going to be some names on here that I'm not sure how to pronounce.
Oh, not to worry.
So I might just skip over them. "And the Lord threw them into a panic before Israel, who slew them with a great slaughter at Gibeon, and chased them by the way of the ascent of Bethhoron, and smote them as far as Azekah and
Makeda." Yeah.
Okay.
Doing good.
Did you see verse 11 too?
Yeah, please.
"And as they fled before Israel, while they were going down the ascent of Bethhoron, the Lord threw down great stones from heaven upon them as far as Azekah, and they died. There were more who died because of the hailstones than the men of Israel killed with the sword."
All right, thank you. So how were the Amorites overcome? Said Jehovah confounded them before Israel. I think Richard said it caused them to panic. So to be confounded means to be confused or to be bewildered. The King James uses the word discomfited, which means to defeat or to overthrow. So the prime mover, the prime person in this activity is Joshua? Israelites? Jehovah. Jehovah God. Yeah. It says Jehovah slew them, struck them with a great slaughter, pursued them. The Israelites pursued them as they fled, up and down. So this is hilly country, like I mentioned just a bit ago. Then it says that Jehovah threw large stones from heaven on them. They died. Well, the first couple of times I read through these verses, I just saw these big stones, pieces of granite and basalt, being thrown by God. But you continue on reading that I believe these are all hailstones. They're not stones. Because this text says more died from the hailstones than by the storm. So is that possible for a person to die from in a little hailstorm? Excuse me?
They died by the hailstones more than they died from the swords.
Yeah. Did I say it backwards?
You just
said
stones twice.
Yeah.
Okay.
But it does
call
them
large rocks. So, you know, I've been through some hailstorms here in Oregon, but not like what's being talked about here. We've seen on our television, I'm sure, some of the hailstorms that they have back in the Midwest, where they're golf ball size and bigger. They knock windshields out of cars and make the car look like it's a bag of walnuts. Bill?
It says great stones here. You know, I've visualized foot-sized balls of ice falling down on these guys. They may have even been bigger than that.
Could very well have been, but whatever size they are, we know it's enough to kill a man, isn't it? And back in the Midwest, when they have some of these hailstorms, they run out as fast as they can if they know it's coming and get their livestock in undercover, anything that they value, children, maybe even spouses, I don't know. So absolutely, it is possible. Deuteronomy 7, verses 22 and 23. The text there says that Jehovah your God will clear away these nations before you, will deliver them, will throw them into great confusion. So, I guess if you wanted to suppose far enough, you could just say that, well, the Israelites could set out their lawn chairs and just watch the fun. Carol's shaking her head no.
No, they had their part. They had to go up. Then God confused them. When you talked about it and say, well, how does he confuse them? What's it sort of like? It made me think of a herd of cattle in a lightning storm. They don't know which way to go. One of them goes and everybody else goes after. Nothing makes sense. They just go whichever direction somebody went.
Okay.
Which is the direction God wanted them to go.
We all have our part, don't we? Yep, we all have our part. Okay. So question number 7. What is written in the book of Jasher? Well, first off, let's read verses 12 and 13. Excuse me. And Frank, would you read those two verses for us, please?
That day the Lord allowed the Israelites to defeat the Amorites.
And that day Joshua stood before all the people of Israel, and they said, he said to the Lord, sun, stand still over Gibeon. Moon, stand still over the valley of, what's the name of that?
Ahijon?
Okay.
Something like that.
So the sun stood still and the moon stopped until the people defeated their enemies. The words, these words are written in the book of Jasar. The sun stopped in the middle of the sky. It waited to go down for a full day. That has never happened and at any time before, and the day, that day before or since.
All right.
Truly, the Lord was fighting for Israel.
Okay, thank you. So, what is written in the book of Jasher? Is that book in our Bible?
No.
No. Whose Bible is it in? The Catholics have it in their Bible. Is that right, Dean? No?
I don't believe the book of Jasher is. This is not one of the apocryphal books that were written between the 2nd and 5th centuries. This is probably a historical account that a scribe named Jasher wrote down. And you find those books referenced in different places in the Old Testament, the Chronicles of the Kings.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I did a little scratching around in my library, which amounts to the computer, believe it or not. And I found this particular reference in the book of Jasher, which is also known as the book of Maccabees. And you've all probably heard of Judas Maccabeus before. And this is a reference to something that in book 3, chapter 12, verses 15 and 16 in the book of Jasher or book of Maccabees. This is something that Judas Maccabeus has been doing. The whole book 3 concerns some of his exploits. And verse 15 reads, "Wherefore Judas with his company, calling upon the great Lord of the world, (parentheses) who, without any rams or engines of war, did cast down Jericho in the time of Jehovah, (parentheses) again, gave a fierce assault against the walls, and took the city by the will of God, and made the unspeakable slaughters, insomuch as that a lake 2 furlongs broad, near adjoining thereunto, being filled full, appeared to be running with blood." And that reading was referenced to compare against Joshua chapter 6 and 20, which, of course, is the taking of Jericho. So you notice how the language is so much different than anything we read in the Bible, for one thing. Like what thing, the graphic part of the lake that looked like it was a lake full of blood. That kind of reached out and struck me. Now, as far as I know, Jasher, the book of Jasher is referenced one more time in the Old Testament. It's referenced in 2 Samuel verse 1, or chapter 1 and verse 18, and refers to the Song of the Bow, which I looked through my book of Jasher that I got up on the computer, and I couldn't find any reference to the Song of the Bow. But it's a song about war in the Old Testament. So now maybe you know a little bit or have a vague idea about the book of Jasher. It's a very descriptive book. In particular, I believe, about the exploits of the Maccabees. Back to the question, and the reading in particular. What a day, right? What a day. Joshua asks Jehovah, O sun, stand still at Gibeon. O moon, in the valley of Ahijah, or Ahijah, anyway, that word. So they did, for about a whole day, until the nation avenged themselves, till the Israelites avenged themselves against the Ammonites. And an FYI here, this is the sun and the moon standing still for approximately a day, is mentioned in Habakkuk chapter 3 and verse 11. So this event happened long enough, or until the nation avenged themselves. So what does it mean to avenge? Do we get to avenge ourselves today? Is that something that's legal?
In court.
In court?
Maybe.
Aren't you supposed to get justice in court, not vengeance? Vengeance is mine, saith the Lord. Okay, to avenge means to get revenge for wrongs. Wrongs done to you or to your family or person. Infliction of deserved punishment. So, I believe that's what the Israelites were doing there. Inflicting deserved punishment. Carol?
Is this the same instance, because it says it never happened before or after, that Joshua's hands were held up during the battle? That says the same time, because that was the time period where the sun stood still, too.
This is a different battle. Yeah, the moon didn't stand still in that one.
No.
So, did I hear some mumbling? Someone make a point? Okay.
The hour, you're talking about the battle with Moses.
Yeah. Had his arm propped up.
I think the hours were extended, were they not?
That's the way I remember it, yeah. Okay, back to avenging. I said it's the infliction of deserved punishment, and I think that fits the situation here with Joshua and fighting against the Ammonites. And why would I say that, that the punishment was deserved? Do I have any grounds to say that?
Maybe because they were attacking the Gibeons, but also God told them to destroy everybody in that land.
That's right. Think Deuteronomy, right? What is this called? It's called putting under the ban, remember? They were to go in and put all these cities under the ban. They were to go in and destroy every living thing. Some situations they were to totally burn the city, and other situations they were told they could take spoils. So that's why I say that it could be called deserved punishment. Because God told the Israelites they were to go in and destroy every living thing. So why did the Amorites deserve all of this? Besides the fact of being under the ban, they attacked Israel via the covenant that Israel had made with the Gibeonites. Okay. Everybody agree? Or disagree? We will move on. If nothing else, it's all food for thought. Okay, how is the day described in verse 14? Described. That sounds like a... what? Double negative? Described? Poor wording on that sentence, my bad. So, verses 14 and 15, And there was no day like that before it or after it, when Jehovah listened to the voice of a man, for Jehovah fought for Israel. Then Joshua and all Israel with him returned to the camp to Gilgal. So how was the day described? Jane?
There's no other day like it.
No day like it? When?
Then or since.
Then or since. Before it or after it. How so? What's the qualifier there? Things, miraculous things like this have happened before. So what's the qualifier?
Because the Lord listened to Joshua.
Yeah, that's it. Because the Lord Jehovah listened to the voice of a man. Deuteronomy chapter 1, verse 30 tells us that Jehovah fights on your behalf, talking to Moses. The final part of that is that Joshua and Israel return to camp, to Gilgal. So Gilgal seems to be kind of like one of their main camps, or one of their resupply places. So how many Ammonites perished in question number 9? Did someone say all of them?
All of the kings. Only the 5 kings.
Let's
go back to the 5 kings instead of the 10.
That's right. They're still hiding in the cave.
I'm sorry to say you guys are wrong.
There were people that escaped into their cities.
That's right. Not all of them, because we see in verse 20 that some fled to fortified cities. Carol?
I just think it's interesting that God killed more with the stones than Israel cut down with the sword, but Joshua still had to have the sun held. That had to be a huge, mighty army if God killed more, but they had to have the day extended in order to kill less than what God killed.
It was a great slaughter, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Okay, excuse me. So verses 16 through 21 will describe our question number 9. How many Ammonites perished? Vicki, would you please read verses 16 through 21 for me?
Sure, Bob.
Yes, I will.
I like a little enthusiasm in your voice there.
Now the 5 kings had fled and hidden in the cave at Mekkah. When Joshua was told that the 5 kings had been found hiding in the cave at Mekkah, he said, "Roll large rocks up to the mouth of the cave and post the men there to guard it. But don't stop. Pursue your enemies, attack them from the rear, and don't let them reach your cities. For the Lord your God has given them into your hand." So Joshua and the Israelites destroyed them completely, almost to a man, but the few who were left reached the fortified cities. The whole army then returned safely to Joshua in the camp at Mekkah, and no one uttered a word against the Israelites.
Thank you very much. So we already answered the question, how many perished? Not all of them. Some fled to fortified cities. We saw that in verse 20. But the admonition was in the reading, do not allow them to enter their cities. Pursue them. Attack them in the rear. I had a little footnote on mine that says, smite their tail. Then the King James Version said, consume them. So it was a horrific battle, and I believe that, yeah, we addressed the kings in the 11th, question number 11, but we see here that the kings were captured and put in a cave. So how did the Israelites' reputation fare? Did it take a hit?
Honorable.
It was honorable. It went up. Okay. the phraseology gives you some room, some latitude there to put your own kind of definition on it. At least in the New American Standard, it reads in verse 21, no one uttered against any son of Israel. I had a little footnote in mine that said, sharpened his tongue. No one had any bad words to say about any of the sons of Israel. The King James said, none moved his tongue. So, people are still melting before the Israelites. So, what did Joshua do to the five kings? Lee, would you read us verses 22 and 20 through 24, please?
Then Joshua said, open the mouth of the cave and bring these five kings out to me from the cave. And they did so, and brought these five kings out to him from the cave, and the king of Jerusalem, and the king of Hebron, and the king of Jarmuth, and the king of Lachish, and the king of Eglon. And it came about when they brought these kings out to Joshua, that Joshua called for all the men of Israel, and said to the chief of the men of war who had gone with him, come near, put your feet on the necks of these kings. So they came near and put their feet on their necks.
Thank you. I see my grandmother stepping on the neck of a chicken, getting ready for our dinner. Yeah.
It works.
So, what did Joshua do to the five kings? Well, we know that they're already trapped in a cave, aren't they? They were trapped in a cave, put on ice, so to speak, while the battle continued. So Joshua wanted to make sure that their interest wasn't taken away from the battle. Wanted to stay on top of what was going on, but yet the kings were confined by putting the rocks, large rocks, in front of the cave. So in the reading we find out he comes after the battle's over, bring them out to me, king of Jerusalem, Hebron, Jarmuth, Lachish, Elgon. Well, evidently they got killed in the battle. Are you making trouble there, Ron?
See which one?
Yeah, yeah, which one is right. Here again, we go back to Deuteronomy. In chapter 7, verses 24, the text there reads, he will deliver their kings into your hand. And yes, indeed. It happens just as was written in Deuteronomy. So Joshua calls forth the chief men of war, the New American Standard says, come near, put your feet on the necks of the kings. Why would he do that?
Hold them down.
Hold them down. Well, don't you think there's probably a pretty big crowd there? I mean, they wouldn't really be worried about him escaping, right? Because there'd be too many people there.
It's total humiliation.
It is indeed that, isn't it? Yeah, yeah.
See this on reliefs, various like Assyrian.
Oh yeah, yeah.
Stuff. You see the king with his foot on their neck.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So that brings it up front and personal, doesn't it? Especially for that person that has their foot on someone else's neck. You know something's gonna happen for sure, which it does. So in verse 25, who should not fear or be dismayed? That sounds like a dumb question, doesn't it? When I first read that, I had to stop and read through it a couple again to make sure who was talking. Who's the them? Was it the kings or the sons of Israel? Don't be afraid. Don't be dismayed. just because I have my foot on your neck, don't be afraid. It's going to be all right. Well, why would Joshua say that to these fearless fighters? Carol?
They still have
more fighting to do, you say?
They still have more fighting to finish taking the land.
Yeah, that's true.
God's still with them.
Yeah.
Isn't the foot on the neck, isn't that a total power play by the victor to show that this king has no more power, that they're totally under my control?
Yeah, kind of what Ron said. Yeah.
We don't typically think that way, but I remember watching when the statue of Saddam Hussein was pulled down, and the people came up and hit the statue with their shoes. And that kind of, I think in the Middle East, this kind of a gesture carries a lot more importance than what it would carry for us.
They're big on insults, aren't they?
Yeah.
They take them.
And it's something about shoes. Remember when the guy threw his shoe at President Bush?
Yes.
And then Gorbachev with his shoe on that podium?
Yeah. There's something about...
Or Khrushchev it was.
That whole image...
Yeah.
That's really important in that part of the world.
Yeah. Well, my mind went in another direction, too. When a person is in the heat of war and he's killing, he or she are killing people right and left, you can't, you don't identify with that person that you're killing. This is what I've heard. In fact, I just watched a TV program on Vietnam, and they were interviewing this fellow, and he was telling his story. He said, I only killed one person in Vietnam. And he said, my job was to mow them down, and I did it. But I didn't kill human beings. He used all these different ethnic names that are applied to the enemy. Zips and gooks and slant eyes, and so he didn't view who he was killing as a human being. It was the enemy, somebody that was to be exterminated, and they are of no value except they're trying to kill us. We got to get rid of them. He says that's the only way I could make it through my tour in Vietnam. And so I was thinking about this scenario in Joshua. In that same respect, that when the men are out in war, they're too busy thinking about surviving and taking down the enemy. But when they're all done with the battle and they've recuperated and they have these five kings to take care of, come up and stick your foot on their neck, well, all of a sudden it comes up really personal. And you're taking the life of a human being. And you can't help but know that because you've got your foot on their neck. So, I don't know if maybe I'm all wet or whatever, but it's an important thing to take someone's life, whether it's your enemy or someone that's trying to harm you or your family or whatever. It's not something we take lightly. Like we see on our television. And we're going to end the class there unless someone would like a rebuttal or like to add something else. I thank you for your responses tonight and for all your help. Even you two Rons over there. Appreciate it.